Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 13, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call and our discussion of the new book by U.S. Senator Mike Lee. The book's title, Our Lost Constitution, the willful Subversion of America's Founding Document. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today Senator Mike Lee, talking again about his book, the title of which, Our Lost Constitution, The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document. It's available at Amazon.com. I checked this morning. It's number one in several categories. We're very pleased to have you, Senator. For our audience's benefit, let me give you a brief introduction. Mike Lee was elected senator in 2010 as Utah's just their 16th senator. His father, Rex Lee, served as the Solicitor General under President Ronald Reagan. And Senator Lee is fond of telling tales about kitchen table conversations with the family that included the intricacies of many constitutional provisions. And I'm wondering if that maybe became the outline for the first draft of this book. He went on to graduate from BYU University with a Bachelor of Science in Political Science, and then attended and graduated from BYU's Law School, where he served as the chapter of the Federalist Society chapter president there. He then was a law clerk to Judge D. Benson, the U.S. District Court for the District of Utah, and then served as a law clerk for then-Judge Samuel A. Alito. He went on to have stints with Sidley and Austin, and then as U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney in Salt Lake City, and then as he served with Governor John Huntsman as his General Counsel in Utah, finally clerked again for Justice Alito, this time on the Supreme Court. So he comes to us not just as a senator or congressman who happens to be a lawyer, but I like to think of you as a lawyer who happens to be a U.S. senator. So with that, Senator Lee is going to give us some opening remarks, about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll take your questions. So, Senator Lee, please go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you to the rest of you for joining this call. The Federalist Society has been an important part of my professional development over the last couple of decades, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to do this. So I wrote this book, Our Lost Constitution, not as a policy book so much as a history book. The focus of the book is really on a series of little-known stories about the Constitution's creation and also about its erosion. Every chapter offers a surprising tale of one sort or another about our founding document and about the stunning lengths that people have gone to subvert it, to circumvent it, to make it less relevant to our time and less applicable. So this is a story that really is about 250 years in the making. I tell the story, for example, of how Alexander Hamilton actually proposed a monarchy at the Constitutional Convention. The other founders hated this idea, and appropriately so, and they hated the idea so much that it probably ruined Hamilton's chances of ever becoming president. He had what appeared to most at the convention to be a promising political career ahead of him, but that sort of got tanked at the convention. Even though he went on to hold other prominent positions in government, he would never quite make it to the office of the presidency, in part because of this miscalculation. The interesting thing is that the founders were so unified in their opposition to his idea of a monarchy within the federal government for one simple reason. They feared the excessive concentration of power in the hands of the few or in the hands of one person. And they understood that the risks of this were especially high with a large national government. It's interesting to reflect on that nowadays, in part because we now have an executive branch that has the power, in effect, to legislate. Our federal regulatory system imposes some $2 trillion in regulatory compliance costs on the American economy every year. And as I explain in the book, I've got two stacks of documents in my office that help explain what our federal regulatory system does to us every year. One stack of documents is 11 feet tall and consists of 80,000 pages. It's last year's Federal Register. The other stack is only a few inches tall and consists of just a few hundred pages, pages of legislation passed by Congress last year. So 80,000 pages and 11 feet of federal regulations compared to a few inches and a few hundred pages of legislation passed by Congress. Now, some would say the few hundred pages of new legislation might be too much. They might have a point. But 80,000 pages is a whole lot more. It brings to mind something I quote from Federalist 62 in the book. Federalist 62 says in pertinent part, and I'm paraphrasing here, that it'll be of little benefit to the American people that their laws may be written by individuals of their own choosing if those laws are so voluminous and complex and ever-changing that they can't reasonably be read and understood by the people governed by them. Well, today, as evidenced by these 80,000 pages of Federal Register that we tend to get every year, our laws are excessively voluminous and complex and ever-changing. But it's worse than that because they're not even written by men and women of our own choosing. They're written by men and women who, while well-educated and well-intentioned and hard-working, very much devoted to the cause that they're assigned to address, they're not subject to elections, ever. They don't really even work or stand accountable to anyone who, in turn, stands accountable in elections. And that's a problem. One of the reasons I decided to write this book and to write it the way I did has to do with the fact that I've learned over the years that if you just talk about the Constitution in the abstract, if you just quote the text, it's very easy to lose people. It's very easy to lose any interest that you might have otherwise found among your audience. But as my wife explained to me initially when I was trying to explain the Constitution to our children when they were younger, and later as I was trying to express constitutional principles to friends and neighbors and eventually constituents and voters, it goes down a lot easier if you put it in the form of a story. If you tell the story behind something, people can become a part of it. It helps draw them in and helps them think through how they themselves would react in that circumstance. It helps make them feel a degree of passion about the issue. And so that's why I tell the story about Hamilton. It's also why I tell stories in my chapter about the 10th Amendment and how the 10th Amendment has in some ways become a dead letter part of our Constitution. That chapter begins with a story about a duel in which a younger pre-presidential Andrew Jackson was involved. His strategy actually involved a willingness to get shot. He decided that because his opponent was a quicker draw and a more accurate shot than he was, he would actually allow his opponent to take the first shot. He was planning to get shot, and he did in fact get shot, but he decided, well, there's a decent chance that I can survive getting shot, and then I can take the second shot and win and kill my opponent. Well, that's exactly what he did. And later on, as President of the United States, he was able to stare down his opponents in Congress and veto legislation that he believed was outside of Congress's power, under the Commerce Clause. I explain in this chapter that the dramatic expansion of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, especially during the New Deal era, has made the 10th Amendment rather less significant. I used to be bothered by Justice Stone's explanation that the 10th Amendment states simply a truism, that all is retained by the states, which hasn't been handed over to the federal government. And the more I thought about it, the more I've realized it actually is true. It actually is accurate. In other words, the 10th Amendment is meaningless to the extent that any power granted to Congress or all powers in the aggregate are without limit. The Tenth Amendment means only as much as the powers granted to Congress are in some way or another limited. And this chapter tells the story about FDR's first inaugural, the part of the speech that no one remembers. FDR laid out a pretty radical vision in which the federal government would have almost unlimited power and in which the president could practically ignore Congress if the president chose. It went against everything the founders thought the Constitution protected, and it was the foundation for a lot of the problems that we have today, including things like Obamacare. It's only because we've lost meaning of the Constitution's limits on federal power that we got Obamacare and that we've got a lot of other things that today are hindering economic growth and making it harder for people to get ahead. It's my belief that two of the most important aspects of the Constitution deal with limitations on power, deal with making sure that no one entity or person within government gets too much power. There are vertical protections that we refer to commonly as federalism that are there to make sure that most powers are to be exercised closest to the people by states and local governments. And there are horizontal protections that we refer to as separation of powers, making sure that one branch of government makes the law, another branch of government enforces and implements the law, and yet another branch of government interprets the law when deciding cases and controversies brought before the jurisdiction of the courts. We have allowed both of those protections, the vertical protection of federalism and the horizontal protection of separation of powers, to become eroded. It's my belief that we've got to restore those protections. But in order to restore them, I think we have to look back to the stories that led to the development of those same principles of the Constitution. And I also think it's important to highlight the stories of how those protections have been eroded and obscured over the years. It's my hope and my belief that in time we can restore the lost portions of our Constitution. I think we will do that, in part because I believe in the vision articulated by and widely attributed to Winston Churchill, who said that the American people can always be counted on to do the right thing, at least after they've exhausted every other alternative. I don't think Winston Churchill was necessarily intending that as a compliment at the time he made that statement. And yet, I take it as such. I take it as a compliment because I tend to believe that's one of the things that differentiates America from other nations, that we are a nation in which we believe in doing the right thing, in which we do believe in following the rule of law. And I also tend to think that we have given a good long try. We've given big, progressive, unlimited, unfettered government, at least 80 years. And as we have done so, we've discovered that it creates a lot of problems. And so I think it's time for us to restore our lost Constitution, to get back to our basic principles, and to start making the case more aggressively that more Americans can get more of what they want out of government and less of what they don't want out of government. If more decisions are able to be made or are pushed back to the state and the local level, where each individual has more access to and influence over the government. That's why I wrote this book, and that's why I'm anxious to share this book with each of you and to discuss it with you today.
Well, thank you, Senator Lee. I certainly appreciate those opening remarks. Let's do check in with the audience. We've got quite a few people on the phone. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, you have a question for the senator. You need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for the senator, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick commercial announcement here for our upcoming Teleforum calls. Wednesday at noon, we'll be talking about the CFPB. That's an entity not mentioned in the senator's opening remarks, but it is one example some of our members feel of an instance where an agency has overstepped some bounds. That's Wednesday at noon. It's a monthly report. The CFPB is so active, we have a monthly call on them alone. And then on Thursday at 3 p.m., we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum in what is becoming a highly visible challenge to the EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act. That's a D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals case. One of our folks is going to be in the oral argument, Rob Gassaway of Kirkland & Ellis, and then he'll host a Teleforum call Thursday at 3 p.m. Today, of course, Senator Lee, push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Let me start things off here, Senator, if I could, by congratulating you. It's a terrific book. The Use of Stories is great. It's an eminently readable book. You discuss some dire topics, but it's done in a way that I think is really accessible, not just to lawyers on this call, but I bought copies for my father and father-in-laws for Father's Day. So well done, first of all. Let me ask you about the way you close the book. You have a series of chapters, one titled Reclaiming the Constitution Through the Courts, Reclaiming the Constitution Through Legislation, Reclaiming the Constitution Through the Power of the Purse, and then what you, the reader, can do to reclaim the Constitution. If you could do, I mean, distill that to one or two major things that need to be changed to reclaim the Constitution, that might be an unfair question to ask you, but is there, if you had your druthers, if you could make one or two things over completely, what might those be?
Okay, great question. So one of the primary purposes of the book is to try to reinforce to people the idea that the Constitution is not simply a court thing. In other words, there is a temptation among lawyers, among lawmakers, and to some extent among Americans at large, to think that when we're talking about a constitutional problem with a particular thing that government's doing, that the solution must involve the courts, and only the courts, and that it's not necessarily something that is appropriate for a mainstream political conversation and dialogue. And that's one of the things that I try to undo. We've got strong indication, first of all, that the founding generation understood that the Constitution would and should still be part of our ongoing national political dialogue. George Washington, for example, said that the power under the Constitution will always be in the people. And he said it's entrusted for certain defined purposes and for a certain limited period to representatives of their own choosing, and whenever it, meaning the Constitution, is executed contrary to their interest or not agreeable to their wishes, their servants can and undoubtedly will be recalled. And so really what he is envisioning there is that from time to time the American people would take a look at their government and say, hey, this is not how we read the Constitution. We don't like it being read this way, the way that our elected officials are reading it, and so this needs to change. So I explained that there are certain things that can and should happen within Congress to turn these things around, and that in many instances we can legislate our way out of a bad constitutional box. It's very, very important for us to do that whenever we get the chance. I would love to see, for example, Congress legislating itself out of the constitutional box that Congress itself has created with the Legislative Powers Clause. Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1, which I discuss at length in the book, says that all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. And as Charles de Montesquieu, who was probably the most influential political philosopher among in terms of his impact on the founding generation, as he is credited to have said, the legislative power involves the power to make law, not the power to make lawmakers. And instead, what has happened is that we've had a legislative branch, Congress, that has been very anxious to make lawmakers rather than to make law. I'd like to see that turned around, and I'd like to see Congress pass the REINS Act. REINS Act, R-E-I-N-S, it stands for Regulations in Need of Scrutiny. And if enacted into law, the REINS Act would help restore the Legislative Powers Clause by saying that for every new regulation, at least all new major rules, the rule in question couldn't carry the force of law unless or until it had been affirmatively enacted into law by the House and by the Senate and then signed into law by the President. It's one of the most effective means by which we could restore our lost Constitution, particularly as it relates to the legislative power. I'd also like to see more men and women elected to the Senate and to the House of Representatives based on a platform of limited government, based on a platform of restoring our lost Constitution, of restoring limits to what the federal government does and who does it. And so that's why in those final chapters of the book, I explain what the typical citizen can do in terms of asking the right questions to candidates, whether they're incumbents or challengers, that can help tease out whether or not the candidate in question is a believer in constitutionally limited government. With respect to restoring the Constitution through the courts, I tell the story of how the Second Amendment was thwarted. I tell stories behind its creation to explain that really this right can be traced all the way back to the English Bill of Rights coming out of the Glorious Revolution in 1688, in which the rights of Englishmen to bear arms to protect themselves was established. It goes all the way back to the time of the Glorious Revolution. And I tell the story of how the Second Amendment was weakened initially by a bad court ruling, but an ambiguous court ruling, how it was further weakened by some off-the-cuff remarks made by Chief Justice Burger shortly after his retirement from the Supreme Court, and how it was ultimately strengthened and reinvigorated as a result of some very well-thought-through and well-planned litigation efforts that culminated in the Heller decision just a few years ago, in which the court was able to restore the protections of the Second Amendment, making clear that this was an amendment that provides an individual right and does not just confer a group right. So sometimes we have to litigate in order to restore the Constitution, but most of the time we can and we should try to restore the Constitution, those provisions of it that have been lost through the political process. And I'd like for both of those to be occurring simultaneously.
Well, let's take the first question from the audience today.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. I object to the title. The words are discouraging, and we have too much discouragement on this subject already. Particularly, too many lawyers are inclined to become legal realists and say, well, all of what you're saying about the Constitution may be true. I understand where we are, how we got here, and why, but I can't get to where we need to go and do what's right for my clients. I need to do what is right to get them to win their cases, and that means often violating the Constitution further. So we have a fundamental disconnect there. I find when I'm talking to people that most of them do know where we are, how we got there, but they don't have a clear-cut course of action. The REINS Act is a good start, but we need 1,000 more pieces of legislation like it to cover every subject and to overturn every precedent that we got us to this point.
Senator Lee, a comment?
I certainly don't disagree that the REINS Act is just a starting point, and it's one of many. There are others that I discuss in the book that are also an important part of restoring our lost Constitution. Among them, for example, I describe some legislation I'm working on across the aisle with my colleague, Senator Pat Leahy, who's a Liberal Democrat from Vermont, and I'm not a Liberal Democrat or from Vermont, some legislation that would help protect the right of privacy that the American people claim under the Fourth Amendment. For example, we have, in effect today, a law passed in 1986 called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. That law, on its face, purports to give the government the right to read your email without a warrant as long as that email is at least 180 days old. Now, this was passed in an earlier era, before cloud computing, and long before most Americans owned a personal computer or had any idea what email was, and yet it remains on the books. And so Senator Leahy and I are trying to restore that portion of our Constitution through legislation. He and I have some other legislation that's designed to limit the ability of the federal government to collect metadata on your cell phone usage. Right now, the federal government is collecting data on every one of you. If you have a telephone, every call that you make, every call that you receive, the time of the call, the duration of the call, with whom you're talking, those are all tracked by the government. They're all held in a database by the federal government for a period of 5 years. And I believe this represents a serious threat to our individual liberty, to our privacy under the Fourth Amendment. I tell the story in introducing that concept. I tell the story of John Wilkes, of course, not to be confused with John Wilkes Booth, Lincoln's assassin. I'm referring here to John Wilkes, the English parliamentarian who became a real champion of liberty and who set in motion the sequence of events that would lead to our Fourth Amendment. John Wilkes wrote a weekly news magazine called The North Briton, in which he was from time to time critical of King George III and his administration. And it was with North Briton number 45. These circulars were, these weeklies were numbered, sort of like the Federalist Papers. It was North Briton number 45 that proved to be sort of the last straw. And after he issued number 45, he was arrested, he was imprisoned, he did time, and he was subject to what amounted basically to a general warrant in which his privacy was violated. Now, John Wilkes became something of a folk hero as a result of all of this. The number 45 became synonymous not only with the name John Wilkes, but also with the cause of freedom generally. And it became a cause celeb not only in Great Britain, but also in America. And it's part of what gave us the Fourth Amendment. But as I explain in the book, the Fourth Amendment is something that can be eroded and has been eroded, and unless it's vigorously defended, and unless we vigorously attempt to restore its protections through legislation, like what I've described, then we'll tend to lose it.
Once again, we're speaking with Senator Mike Lee. The book, again, Our Lost Constitution: The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document. Let's take another call from our audience.
Yes, thank you. In terms of addressing the problem through the courts, through the Congress, I guess before one can address a problem, one has to be aware of it. And Senator Leahy's efforts aside, seriously, the Republican Party is the only hope of any substantial change through the courts or through the legislature. Is there an awareness among your Republican colleagues who of the need for really institutional change? You're talking about the need to scrutinize potential federal judicial appointments to see if they care about the continued expansion of the administrative state, or if they are prepared to take Randy Barnett's interpretation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause to cut back the scope of federal DAMAs, or to take the approach of Professor Hamburger's recent book, Is Administrative Law Legal?, which would argue that the whole administrative state is a violation of the Constitution. It's a plausible argument if you read the lengthy book. But are your colleagues prepared to look seriously at these underlying issues, or just nitpick them for public relations reasons from time to time?
Okay, so currently, I wish I could answer that question in the affirmative, but I can't, and so I won't. But there is an awareness there. The only way Congress will act on these really is for there to be a significant change in the attitude of voters. And until members of Congress start hearing a louder, more consistent call from voters that they expect us to rein in the excessive delegation of legislative power, it's not nearly as likely to happen as it should be. So yeah, there are some members of Congress that are cluing into this, but until the call from the voters gets louder, then it's not likely to change. The good news is that it is growing. A few years ago, when I was elected to the Senate in 2010, when I took office in early 2011, overregulation was not something that necessarily came up on Main Street. It was more of a Wall Street issue. But this is something that, with increasing frequency, is coming up at town hall meetings, is coming up on Main Streets throughout my home state and across America, because people are starting to realize the connection here, and they're starting to understand that these $2 trillion in annual regulatory compliance costs have an impact. That first of all, this $2 trillion annual regulatory compliance price tag is unprecedented in the sense that it has increased dramatically over the years. 20 years ago, when I was in law school, I learned that the federal regulatory system was costing the American economy a staggering $300 billion a year, and that is a staggering sum. But it's exploded since then. It's exploded about to the same tune as our national debt. It's exploded six or sevenfold to about $2 trillion a year. That's about two-thirds of what our income tax system costs the economy. And it's not right. It's also the case that people are coming increasingly to an understanding of the fact that these regulatory compliance costs are not simply borne by the top 1%. They're not simply borne by wealthy individuals or by big blue-chip corporations. That these regulatory compliance costs are, in fact, passed downstream. They're paid for in terms of higher prices on goods and services. Everything the American people buy becomes more expensive. They pay for it in terms of higher prices and in terms of unemployment and diminished wages and underemployment. The more people realize this and understand the connection between this and the excessive delegation of the lawmaking power, the more lawmakers will continue to hear from voters, and the more that happens, the more likely we will be to make some real headway in this area. But again, to answer your question succinctly, we're not there yet, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book.
We've got just two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next call. Go ahead, caller. Might have lost our
Hello?
Colleagues. Let's head in a different direction now.
Hi.
Go right ahead, sir.
Senator Lee?
Yes.
This is James Devereaux, originally from Utah, living in Texas right now. You've kind of touched on this a little bit, and I was just wondering regarding judicial interpretation and originalism. It appears that your book sort of takes an originalist take, but more expansive, as in touching on politics and the legislative branch instead of just a judicial branch issue. Does this fall more in line with people advocating judiciary engagement, such as Barnett and the Institute of Justice, or do you feel like there's sort of a deference argument sometimes to be made, or that you're making that case, such as Ed Whelan and other deference advocates?
Okay, I want to make sure I understand your question. You're asking whether or not I take an originalist approach in the book?
Yeah, so your book appears sounds like, I haven't read it yet, but it sounds like there's sort of an originalist argument made from what I'm hearing. But within originalism, there seems to also be a split between those who prefer more traditional engagement, such as the folks at, such as Randy Barnett and the folks at Institute for Justice, or a more deferential action, as you see sometimes on the conservative right. So.
Yeah. Okay. So look, I'm one who approaches originalism from the standpoint that that would conclude that neither judicial activism nor judicial passivism is acceptable, and that when a court is reviewing a particular government action, it is every bit as reprehensible for the court to refrain from acting and to refuse to invalidate some government action that is unconstitutional as it is reprehensible for the court to invalidate as unconstitutional a government act that is in fact wholly consistent with the Constitution. Both of them are equally bad. I also think that my brand of originalism is directed not only at the courts, but is directed also at what I sometimes refer to as coordinate branch construction, or that refers to the duty that each of the coordinate branches of government has toward implementing the Constitution faithfully and in a manner consistent with its text and with its historical understanding. You know, it's one of the reasons why I tell the story of Andrew Jackson and his decision to veto the Maysville Road Bill. He was given political advice by his advisors at the time, saying, look, you've got to sign this. Politically, it's going to be a killer for you if you don't sign it. And he refused to sign it. In fact, he vetoed it because of the fact that it didn't comport with his own reading of the Constitution. He believed that this was outside of Congress's power to enact legislation pursuant to the Commerce Clause, and so he vetoed it. And so this has ramifications for all three branches of government, and I think we need more of that discussion within the government. Now, obviously, we've got a lot of constitutional discussion that goes on in the Supreme Court, but too often in the political branches, what passes for constitutional analysis tends to be a quick assessment of what the Supreme Court either will or won't approve, or what the Supreme Court either will or will not invalidate. And I don't think that's right. I refer to a Republican president, for example, who signed into law a campaign finance reform measure while acknowledging that that same measure had some constitutional problems with it. But this particular Republican president said, more or less, we'll let the courts worry about the constitutional issues. That is part of the problem that we have here, and we need for members of Congress in each branch of government, including and especially the political branches, to engage more deeply in an actual independent constitutional analysis. Because not every constitutional issue is necessarily likely to come up in the courts. And the courts aren't always well equipped to delve into each and every constitutional issue. And the courts sometimes get it wrong. And that's why, particularly considering that the most important feature of the Constitution involves its limitations on government power, it's better to have multiple backstops, multiple barriers to the federal government acting in ways that it shouldn't. You don't have that if really you have only one constitutional referee. We need constitutional referees in all three branches of government.
Senator Lee, this is Dean. I'm wondering at what point, in your opinion, the presumption of constitutionality should just sort of evaporate. We have midnight passage of bills that are written by staff, hundreds of pages long, even thousands of pages long. They go unread by members before they vote on them. There are even provisions for expedited judicial review, which sort of underscores your notion in the legislative branch of let the courts sort it out. But then the courts start with a presumption that what Congress passes and the president signs is constitutional. Is that an earned sort of deference or presumption? And whether it is or not, are we at a point where that presumption should no longer be in place?
I wish I could tell you that it's well earned, but I don't think it is, especially because of the dynamics that I've described a moment ago, that constitutional analysis is not exactly something that Congress has engaged in aggressively, and that's putting it very, very mildly. So I don't think that starting from a presumption of constitutionality is necessarily warranted there, unless all the court is doing is saying, you know, we're not going to presume something is unconstitutional. We've got to have an actual reason why we're being asked to invalidate something if we're being asked to invalidate it on constitutional grounds. But beyond that, I don't think that a very strong presumption is warranted. Especially, again, considering the fact that the Constitution's single most important feature is to limit federal power, is to protect the people from excessive government interference, with the understanding that the Founding Fathers had, and based on their experience in colonial America with a large, distant national government, that taxed the people too much, that regulated them oppressively, was so far from the people that it was so sometimes slow to respond to their needs. That's why they instinctively put in place a limited purpose national government, because they understood that we need national governments for some distinctively national purposes, like providing for our national defense, regulating trade or commerce between the states and with foreign nations, with the Indian tribes, protecting trademarks, copyrights, and patents, adopting a uniform system of weights and measures, declaring war, and granting letters of marque and reprisal. Those kinds of things were distinctively and unavoidably federal in nature. They were national in nature. But all other powers were intended to be exercised at the state level and at the local level. And that's one of the many reasons why I think starting from a strong presumption that something is constitutional, that it is within Congress's power, may not be warranted, especially given how generously and how expansively Congress has tended to examine its own powers. It's interesting, if you review some of the case law starting in 1937, dealing with the Commerce Clause. If you examine some of the things that the court said in cases like NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steel and Wickard v. Filburn, the court wasn't necessarily saying this is what the commerce power is. There was some of the court's analysis that basically said we can't make every one of these decisions. Some of these decisions have to be made within the political branches of government, and here are the terms and conditions on which we will either intervene and invalidate or refrain from doing the same. I suspect from reading those opinions that the court intended more aggressive, vigorous analysis than has actually gone on in Congress since then. Congress, for the most part, has seen those cases as providing a perpetually green light, suggesting that if Congress can see something, it can regulate it, and that there's very little, if any, restriction on that.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes left. We've got now 7 questions pending, so let's try and get to as many of our callers as possible.
Hi, Senator. This is Tony Cotto in Washington, D.C. I'm wondering if you have any sort of thoughts on your counterparts in state legislatures and what they can do.
Sure. So, as I've said in the past, I think it's important to have kind of a push and a pull strategy, and that at the same time that we need lawmakers, ideally lawmakers from both political parties and both houses of Congress from every part of the country, attempting to push power back to the states and local governments. We also need for state and local lawmakers to be pulling that power back, to be encouraging Congress to push it back to them and making the case for it. The more this can be a bipartisan effort, the better, because as I explain in the book, federalism should not be simply a Republican thing or a conservative thing, and in fact it isn't. I provide examples of this in my book. For example, I explain in my book that there are people in Vermont, arguably most of the people in Vermont, would like to have, as I understand it, a government-run, government-funded, single-payer health care system. It would actually be easier for them to get there, to do that, if we respected federalism more. And as a result of that, you'd have more people in Vermont getting more of the kind of government they want and less of the kind of government they don't want. Now, I'm not from Vermont. I'm from Utah, and the people in Utah wouldn't necessarily want that same kind of system. It's one of the reasons why I live in Utah rather than Vermont. But the people in Utah would get more of what they want in government, of less of what they don't want in government, if more of their decisions are made closer to home. The more we can have state lawmakers, rather whether they're from Vermont or Utah or somewhere else, explaining what it is that their constituents would prefer and highlighting the areas in which the federal government makes it harder for them to provide the kind of government their constituents want, the easier it's going to be for us in Washington to push that power back when we've got willing participants on the other end ready to pull the power back as we hand it to them.
A reminder to our audience, we provided a link to the Amazon page of the book, Our Lost Constitution, in the notice you got of today's call. So please feel free to use that. And now let's go to our next caller.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead. We can hear you.
Oh, hi. Senator Lee, hi. This is Stephen Eugene. I'm an attorney in New York City. I just had one question. You've talked a lot about federalism, which, of course, I totally agree with, and the need to push power back to the states, but it seems to me, and I could be one of the very few people who thinks this, but it seems to me that one of the major problems has been the 17th Amendment, which is the direct election of senators. Because it seems to me prior to that amendment, you had senators who were interested in keeping power to the states because they were appointed by the states. But now that they're sort of like free agents and it's all about like their political party, they are interested in amassing more power in Washington. So I wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a fair question. And look, there's no question, there's no doubt that the Constitution was changed rather significantly in 1913. 1913 was a watershed year. It brought us the 16th Amendment with the income tax, the 17th Amendment with the direct election of senators. It brought us Woodrow Wilson, and it brought us the at least the beginnings of the Federal Reserve. There is no question that those things, and the 17th Amendment in particular, changed something in the Constitution because, as you describe, we no longer had the state legislatures choosing representatives in the Senate. In that sense, the state governments were no longer represented as such. The states were still represented equally, but by choice of individual voters throughout the state rather than the state government. I do think, however, a couple of things. First, as strongly as you may feel that way, strongly as anyone else may agree with you, I don't believe that that is political ground that is going to reappear. In other words, I think that's kind of water under the bridge. I politically speaking, the idea of going back to the pre-17th Amendment Constitution or repealing, undoing the 17th Amendment, it's just not going to happen. Not in our lifetime, not a chance. Secondly, I think there is some risk there of falling into the logical fallacy of post hoc ergo proctor hoc. We've had a lot of things that have happened in our government since 1913 when the 17th Amendment was adopted. Not every one of those things can necessarily be attributed to the passage and the ratification of the 17th Amendment. And I think it's also important to remember that we can still restore federalism while having our U.S. senators directly elected by voters in their respective states. The understanding at the time was that you'd have state legislators who were sufficiently self-interested in protecting their own power that they would keep U.S. senators in check and make sure that they didn't excessively expand federal power. But to a very significant degree, we now have voters across the country who are realizing the same thing. And that is another reason why I wrote my book. I wanted to help voters everywhere from all political backgrounds understand that the expanse of the federal government isn't free. It isn't free in terms of the financial costs, and it isn't free in terms of the freedom that we give up and the accountability that we give up when we push all the power to the federal government, or most of it, and then within the federal government, we delegate most of that off to the executive branch. It isn't right. It's not consistent with ordered liberty, and it's certainly not consistent with our Constitution. The more voters can come to understand this, as they are by the day, the greater chance we have of restoring federalism with or even with the 17th Amendment, which I believe is here for good.
Okay, thank you.
As we wind down here, I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible with their questions. We've still got quite a few people on the line waiting to ask a question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. On amendments, after the War of Secession, reformers thought it impossible to make the changes they wanted through either the ordinary legislation or through the courts. So they adopted amendments, mainly to overturn two court decisions, Barron v. Baltimore and Dred Scott v. Sanford. Now, since then, we've had about 200 wrong precedents, and it might very well take as many amendments to overturn them all. But which amendments should we be seeking at this point? And not just the popular ones that everybody likes, like balanced budget amendment, which is very poorly conceived, but amendments that focus specifically on wrong turns in the judicial process.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm not sure which version of the balanced budget amendment you're talking about, but to the extent that you're suggesting that all balanced budget amendments are ill-conceived, I respectfully but very strongly disagree with you. I think that actually ought to be our first priority in terms of constitutional amendments, is to limit the ability of Congress to engage in perpetual deficit spending. And I think a strong balanced budget amendment to the Constitution would require a two-thirds supermajority vote by Congress whenever Congress wants to engage in deficit spending, to raise the debt ceiling, to raise taxes, or spend more than a fixed percentage of GDP, for perhaps 18%, for example, given that our tax system is generally incapable of generating more than roughly 18% of GDP through our existing code. So I think that one is essential. I'd also like to see a constitutional amendment limiting the number of terms that members of Congress may serve. I think senators and congressmen ought to be limited to 12 years in either House of Congress. I'd very much like to see both of those amendments proposed and ratified. And I'd also like to see some variation of an amendment that James Madison drafted, but that was never put into the Constitution, restricting the ability of any branch of government to delegate its powers to another branch of government.
Let's take another call. We've got just a few minutes left here. Good afternoon, Senator. This is Clark Neely from the Institute for Justice.
Hello.
Hi. As you probably know, we focus primarily on litigating, challenging the power of government, and I have kind of two interrelated questions, but basically they come down to this. My sense is that whatever courts say is constitutionally authorized is what the government will do, whether we're talking about state government or Congress. In other words, I get the impression legislators really do look to the courts to see what's permissible and then will exercise every bit of power that, the courts say is permissible under the Constitution. And so it seems to me that they are very interconnected, and I absolutely agree with you that, constitutional compliance should be responsibility of all three branches, but that in no way should ever be perceived to take any of the pressure off of the courts to always get it right.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly, and that's why in making this point, I don't mean to take any pressure off the courts other than to say we ought to have additional protections for the people built into the political branches that currently have recourse only in the courts. In other words, right now, if you ask most people, especially most people in Congress, what do you do when a piece of legislation is unconstitutional? The answer almost always involves the courts and only the courts, when really we ought to have all three branches of government acting independently, each within its own sphere, to stop actions by the government that are incompatible with the text and the historical understanding of the Constitution. But you're exactly right. We still need to keep pressure on the courts and make sure that its decisions are entirely consistent and commensurate with the Constitution.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can sneak one final question in here today.
This is Matt McReynolds of the Pacific Justice Institute. Senator Lee, thank you for this wonderful conversation and the book. I look forward to checking that out. My question is, as a matter of basic premise, I think a lot of us just take for granted the wisdom of the founding fathers, the importance of federalism, and a lot of these concepts. For audiences beyond conservatives, beyond the Tea Party, beyond those who accept that premise, it seems to me that a lot of the American public today doesn't necessarily accept or have reverence for the founding fathers, doesn't much care about this kind of history or about these concepts. And so I'm wondering, what have you found to be most effective to bridge that gap with audiences maybe outside of our comfort zone, the moderates, the independents, ordinary Americans who just may not necessarily be tuned in to the importance of this history?
Well, you know, hypotheticals help when you can imagine a hypothetical government that is less benevolent than many are inclined to think of today. Most people will react differently when they can imagine a scenario in which they wouldn't necessarily like policies coming out of Washington and being imposed on the entire country against the will of many people in many parts of the country where different views are held. And it's also from time to time something that can be helpful to point to historical examples of where people in some parts of the country are being asked to endorse or embrace a government program of one sort or another that that only a small percentage of Americans like. And so that can help. And again, it also helps to just make the point that federalism gives us a way of balancing the rich political diversity that we have in this country, of managing it and managing expectations that people have about their government. It gives more people a way of having more of the kind of government they do want and less of the kind of government they don't want, because it allows those decisions to be made more locally.
Well, Senator Lee, this is Dean Reuter. Let me thank you. You've been very generous with your time, and also thank you, of course, for writing this book, Our Lost Constitution. We certainly appreciate you joining us today. We're going to have to leave a couple questions unanswered. Perhaps we can have you back sometime in the near future to continue the conversation.
That'd be great. I'd enjoy that.
And to our audience, let me thank our audience as well for your time and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Wednesday at noon, when we'll be talking about the CFPB. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.